Sweet. Welcome, everybody. Delighted that you're here. I just caught a little bit, if you're still around, Tim, of your story about getting off your belief. And I'm not sure what all the commentary made, but the piece that I heard, what it resonated for me is the surrender of perception. Are we willing to give up these constructs of carbon-based memory that convince us of all kinds of things that are based in absolute fantasy, generational patterns and such? So, delighted. And Miss Joan, you're with us. How are you, young lady?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
You are loud and clear. Delight to hear your voice.
Thank you.
I've been waiting for your return.
Well, my question has to do with tapping and the field work that you taught us about pressure points.
Right, energy field work.
And how to do that with somebody that we're supporting their field point breathing. How are those points related to tapping?
There may be some coincidental similarities with the tapping and the energy field work that we teach in the Why Is This Happening to Me Again intensive and teacher training, but no, there's no direct correlation between the two. The energy field work is something that I've developed over the last almost 50 years. There are probably 30 different seminars that I've done. And in particular, when I first discovered still point breathing and realized the importance and the depth of still point breathing, what I started to look for in the studies I was doing and the different seminars I would do on physical, mental, emotional medicine, I would look specifically for anything that would induce still point in people. And then I would incorporate that in the energy field work, because still point is really where it all happens. And in fact, I had a young man who's been with us actually for a couple of days. I did, and this is something I haven't done for almost four decades, but I did a one-on-one personal mini intensive over a three-day period here. And the intensity of doing, you know, that direct work and moving into still point on deeper levels than just the mind is, you know, really profound. So I kind of forgotten how much fun it was to take somebody into that deep estate. In fact, I've been talking with Jeannie about maybe we'll make that part of what we do here while we're in Virginia is that I'll do one-on-one intensives, three-day intensive programs with people. But we're sort of talking about that right now. But there's no direct relationship there. But I did have another piece to offer to your question on Friday about how, if I do my work, what's the impact that I can have on another's life, someone that I'm related to, and or even someone who's passed. And my take, an analogy. Go ahead.
It's my former husband, and I.
Right.
I'm encountering some relationship issues with my younger son, and of course, I don't want him to inherit my dysfunctional patterns, so I work on mine. And I'm wondering, as I heal myself, how does that have an impact on my son's father, who's deceased? So
right.
That my son has the advantage of his healing also.
Right. Well, if you think in terms of energy, and remember the primary rule of energy is resonance. And resonance has to do with how matching energy fields exchange energy. You know, if I take a middle C tuning fork and I hit it on a desk and I put it near a second middle C tuning fork, that second tuning fork doesn't have any choice. there's just a pure energy exchange that is going to change the action of the second tuning fork. Now, if I put a middle A tuning fork in front of that middle C, it doesn't matter how hard I hit it or how often, it's not going to create any impact on the middle A tuning fork because they're in different frequency ranges. So my take would be that, you know, there's probably a good chance that your son has some of the energy dynamics genetically of dad, or not a chance, it's definitely there, and there's a good chance there might be some power person dynamics that he acquired through his relationship with dad, and of course, power person dynamics tend to be generational, and probably a good chance that some of those power person dynamics that his dad had played out in your relationship with him. So anything that you haven't resolved or that he hasn't resolved would tend to play out at some point. Because again, it's not a matter of choice. It's not a matter of, I can't say, oh, well, I'm never going to go near that. If this energy moves in someone else and I have a match, I don't have a choice. It's going to move in me. My choice is, what do I do with it? Do I, you know, blame? Do I own it? Do I process through it? Do I use the tools to clean it up? And in terms of how would it impact someone else in the family system or someone who's passed, sort of an analogy for understanding it. I mean, I can't force somebody else to heal an issue, even though I've chosen to face that issue and process through it myself. However, energetically, if I do my deeper work around a given issue, the energy field that I have in relationship to them shifts and opens a space. A good way to explain or what I've come up with to explain it is, let's imagine that, you know, we've all probably had a house with a basement, and there was a basement door, and that old basement door is corroded around the bottom, and there's been water in it, and there've been bugs in it, and a dozen people have tried to get that door open, but nobody's strong enough, and nobody knows how to do anything about it, so that door just stays that way for years. And one day, someone comes along with the skills and the willingness to clean out the track, replace the wheels, lubricate the door so that instead of, you know, you almost have to break your back to open the door, you can just use a finger or two and slide the door open. So if everybody in the family has gone down and tried to open that door, but nobody's ever been successful, and I clean the tracks, I make the door easily manageable, then anybody who comes to that door is going to be able to open it. So while I can't force another to go through it, if I've done the work, it's kind of like I've lubricated the pathway, and it's going to be easier for that person to move through that energy. Whether they're in their bodies or not, doesn't matter. I don't know if you've been on a show where I talked about, about a year and a half ago, I was just by myself, and I was doing a still point session, and I'm laying there with my eyes closed, and I had the instruction as I'm breathing away, there was kind of, you know, some energy moving, and I'm breathing away, and I had the instruction to look down, which I thought was kind of strange. I mean, I'm laying there with my eyes closed, I turned my eyes down, what am I going to see? But I followed the instruction, and as I turned my eyes down, what I could see, and of course it wasn't physical, but what I saw in my mind was a huge field of darkness, like a field so broad, so long, so huge, I could hardly imagine it. And in that field, there were an uncountable number of small white lights, all surrounded in darkness. And the number was like unfathomable. I could have never counted them. And so I'm breathing away, and I see this, and I ask, it's like, what am I looking at? And what I was told is, these are my ancestors, and the darkness that they're still carrying, that they're living in. And they are asking you if you will be willing to take on the energy of that darkness and help to process through it, which, for me, felt like it was a huge privilege and an honor to easily and instantly say yes. And I actually, when I responded, I mean, I was literally asked that question, and I mean, I'm breathing away, I'm by myself in the room, and I answered out loud. I said yes. And the instant that I said yes, my phone rang. Usually when I do a still point session, I've got my phone off. This day I didn't turn it off. And my phone rang. It was beside me, so I reached over and I answered it. And it was my son, Michael J. Now, at that point, my son is, I don't know, 42 or 43. So in 43, he doesn't know my family really well, my personal family, because they were up in Canada and we were down here. We went up there a few times when he was small, but, you know, he didn't have a real connection with too many of the family members. And we'd never had any conversation about ancestry or anything like that. But as I replied that I was willing to process this darkness of my ancestors, Michael J. rings my phone. He says, "Hi, Dad. I'm on Ancestry.com and I need some information about our ancestors."
Wow.
I mean, for me, it was just a signal that, okay, this is right on. This is real, you know? And so we proceeded to have a conversation with that. I went back to my still point session. And in the rest of my still point session, one of the things that came to me was the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane where we're usually fed by churchianity an image of this poor, suffering fellow who is going to be beaten and bruised and take on the sins of the world as a trauma. And, you know, churchianity, many times, at least in my experience, has pounded in the, you drove in the nails, your sin caused this suffering. And what my insight was, like when I got the privilege of being able to say, yes, I'm open and I will process and I will breathe this energy of my ancestors. After I got off the phone with Michael J., I went back to breathing and I got the image of Yeshua in the Garden of Gethsemane, quote unquote, taking on the sins of the world. And it wasn't a burden. It was a privilege. It was an honor to be asked to do that. And it had nothing whatsoever to do with what followed in the way of suffering. It had to do with his arising to a new level of awareness. And, you know, when you come to the conclusion story of the whole suffering picture, we're told that what Yeshua said, and it's interesting, this particular passage, although the Greeks will say it was all written in Greek, the Greek translations even say, this is left in the original Aramaic, and the words are, not that my Aramaic pronunciation is very good, but the words were, sounded something like, Eli, lama sabachthani. And we're told that he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Like, God's hanging on a cross, suffering, forsaken by God. Is there any universe in which that makes any sense? But in fact, what he said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, was more like, rather than being said with dejection and trauma, was said with excitement and insight, because his personal realization was, and the words forsaken, the translation, or pardon me, the misinterpretation, mistranslation, forsaken, the words there in Aramaic are very similar, or forsaken, and set aside for a special purpose. So Yeshua wasn't saying something in dejection and suffering and abandonment. With excitement, he was saying, oh, Papa, Papa, I got it. For this, you reserved me. For this, you set me aside. To rise to the level where I can be the space of active present love and literally take on those energetic dynamics of the world that people don't know how to do. And my take is that each one of us is invited into that place in the garden as we do our work and to process the trauma of the world. And let's get done with it. It's time.
Wow.
And each one of us, yeah. You know, where the Course says, you know, millions yet unborn will benefit from the work you do. Each one of us that takes on and does a piece of work opens an energy window for everybody on the planet who has that same energetic issue. And by you or I working through it, we literally open the energy window, not just for those people in our own family systems or bloodline with that similar issue, whether they're alive or dead, but we open the energy window for everybody on the planet with that issue.
now.
So I'm breathing with you and opening those spaces and hold the space for the right goals to come to mind for you to be canceling on your worksheets around what's moving with your son to clear that space. And I suspect that you or he, you know, when I think back to the conversations we've had about how sweet your relationship is with your son, I would suspect that you and or he have reached some sort of a new level of vitality to be able to allow whatever's coming up to come up. And we certainly join you in holding the space of breathing through and being able to process whatever that's about. And tie it in with the Native Americans when they went into a sweat lodge or a healing ceremony of any kind. There was a phrase that they used, and the phrase was Metaquiasin. You know, if you were going into a sweat lodge, at the door of the sweat lodge, you would bow your head and say, Metaquiasin, which means, for all my relations. Not just doing it for ourselves. For all our relations.
I'm writing this down.
And of course, the archive will be there if you feel inclined to listen to it again. And actually, just being with that whole thing would be really powerful to just do a still point session, like just breathe and go into that and imagine that day on the floor at Heartland when you were waiting for me to show up to do energy field work on you, that you go ahead and breathe and imagine that I, well, even though you're there at home and I'm here, I do show up and do that energy field work on you. I will.
Okay. You mentioned the power person dynamic.
Right.
From the time he was 9 years old, I had full custody of him.
And, right.
Their interactions with their dad were probably more disappointing than enheartened. but I suspect he has, because he lived with me, might have power person issues with me, don't you think?
Well, there's a good chance. Remember, three things happen that instill a power person dynamic within a child's mind, and it is usually an interaction, though not always, usually an interaction between a child and a parent. I've observed over the years that an absent parent, that children developed a powerful power person dynamic around an absent parent. And when they're under stress, their inclination is to be absent, to disappear. I was working with someone last week, and he was dealing with some abuse issues, or what he perceived as abuse between he and his spouse. And as he, you know, saw that happening, he was thinking that it was related to his relationship with his mother. But when we looked at, and the key, how you tell who your power person is in any given situation, because there can be more than one, the way you tell is, whose behavior are you doing? And what he wanted to do, you know, his mother's power person dynamic was to become physically abusive. But that wasn't what happened with him in this situation. His mind went into, well, I'm just going to go move out into the woods and live by myself. I'm going to leave. And that's exactly what his father did. So although he hardly knew his father, you know, he had shared with me previously, it's someone that I've worked with for several years, he had shared with me that, you know, his father only got out of prison to come home and abuse him and his mom, and then he'd leave again. And I mean, he was thinking, oh, this has all got to do with mom. It was like, well, wait a minute now. Did mom leave? No, mom was the only one that was there. Well, who left? Well, dad. Oh, bingo. And so what, under that level of stress, what his mind counseled him to do is, I got to get out of here. And, you know, In when one is ultra stressed, what happens if there's a power person dynamic in the mind is that person will do whatever it was that their power person did to them that they hated the most. And that was his dad left, abandoned him. And he wanted to abandon his wife.
Oh, gosh.
Breathing with
what
you.
I'm observing is that he gets upset with me about something, but he doesn't directly tell me. He just doesn't communicate.
You know, how was his dad at communication?
Not very good.
Yeah. So
but
probably that's the dynamic.
Yeah.
Right. So it could be a power person dynamic that involves both of you. So
yeah. What
I would suggest is that you might want to dig out the responsibility communication protocol and do a responsibility communication with him to work toward inviting and making the space safe. You know, one of the reasons why usually people won't communicate is because in their experience it wasn't safe to communicate. And so doing a responsibility communication exercise with him, emphasizing the safety of opening and communicating and the desirability of that, the blessing of that, might just be the thing that opens the space for him to let go of whatever the underlying dynamic is for him.
Oh, Michael, that would take so much courage. You know, all the thoughts that come up are, oh, I'm going to do it right.
So why do you suppose you weren't very good at communicating? Oh, let me guess. Maybe it was because I won't do it right?
Yeah.
Sounds like your worksheet work is around doing it right.
Uh-huh.
And as you do the responsibility communication with him, and I suggest you do it in writing, I'd suggest that you share with him one of your issues is the fear that you're not going to do this right and that you're going to do it anyway because what you want to do is heal with him and have wide open, honest, true communication with him.
I'm glad you said that about writing it.
Yeah, that will give you the opportunity to do some processing, do some worksheets around what you're writing, what comes up as you're doing it,
yeah. And
then let that space open. And remember that the objective of communication is, I have a reality in my mind that I want to transfer intact to your mind. And that reality might be, gee, son, you know, I have this reality of fear about communicating with you because I won't do it right, and that I'll reinforce the separation between us rather than heal it. And so by communicating something like that and then owning it, and then the invitation part of the responsibility communication tool is, remember, do you have any ideas? Do you have any support for me on how I can heal this? And
right. From
what I know of your son and what you've shared in the past, he'd probably be the first one to just rush right in and open the space to support you in your healing process. Although he has perhaps fear and trepidation.
My oldest son.
Oh, okay. Well, we've got two different sons involved. Okay. That's what I'm thinking of then. Okay.
Well, and I have this reality in my mind that he judges me against his in-laws, who, you know, from the outside, my daughter-in-law had a perfect upbringing. Her parents are just the kindest, sweetest people. I adore them myself. And they're not perfect. And, I carried this feeling, and I've done worksheets on it, but clearly I need to do more, that he judges me against them as the standard.
Right. And so what have you ever looked at whether or not you judge you by the standard of them or someone else?
Oh, that's a good point.
Is that projection?
Yeah, I judge myself against them. I did.
Yeah, so I'd do some worksheets around that issue and let go of that one, and that one just might open the space.
Right.
And remember, the objective is to offer whatever is true in your mind, whatever your reality is, to offer it to him with responsibility and an invitation toward healing, you know, inviting, inspiring his support for your healing, whatever the issue is for you. And in that case, in the case of a parent and child, you know, often many years later, the issue can be one of, well, but of course you always blamed me. Mm-hmm. Has that ever been an issue between you of him, you blaming him?
No.
No? Never?
I don't know. Well, I wouldn't say never. I mean, I can't think right now off the top of my head. I can't think of what I would blame him for.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you ask him? Son, have you ever felt like I've blamed you for anything? And see what he comes back with.
Oh, great idea.
See what he has to say. And, you know, there are two different ways that people can acquire a power person dynamic. One is directly, you know, here I am the parent and look what you've done, you're to blame. That's a direct message from a power person to a child, you're to blame. But that's the active power person dynamic. But there's also a passive power person dynamic. And, you know, it'd be kind of like the reverse of what you're doing with him. That, oh, he's judging me. That would be a passive power, a passive dynamic of taking on a thought disorder that you think is about someone else. And so for him, a passive, you know, power person dynamic might be, well, I did this and mom, you know, stopped talking to me for a day. And I concluded that she was blaming me. Now, that may not be true. If his mind, you know, as a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old or a 2-year-old thinks, oh, mom's gone silent because she's blaming me, and seeing as how silence is a dynamic in the relationship between you now, good chance that he may have just interpreted what he considered to be your silence as blame for him. And so that would be a passive power person dynamic, a thought or disorder taken on passively. And so, you know, creating a space of safety for all of those things to be resolved is a monumental task to do within a family system.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like you're up for the task.
I am. I definitely am.
So, okay, how about picking a number from 1 to 21?
Seven.
Okay, and then a number from 1 to 13.
Five.
Okay, 7-5. So that's a mind shifter from our ever expanding mind shifter list. So I'm going to go to section 7. I'm going to invite you to have your pen handy. So this particular mind shifter, we have a what we call an ever expanding mind shifter list that is part of our monthly mind shifters and still point greedy group. So there are 21 sections in that list at this point, or 21 sections in that set. And the first number, 1 to 21 tells me which section to go to, and it tells me to go to section 7. And what I found, you know, if you remember when you were at Heartland, when we got people to select numbers, it always hit right on whatever the mind shifter would be, just like bingo, right on. So this one just happens to be from the section Healing Generations from Jeannie's book. And 7-5 is, it is safe for me to invite. So if you've got your pen handy, 7-5 is the correct number, right?
Yep.
Okay. It is safe for me to invite the darkest parts of my family history. So 7-5 is from Jeannie's book, Healing Generations, One Breath at a Time. It's safe for me to invite the darkest parts of my family history to come to awareness.
Right. Darkest parts of my family
history.
History.
To come to awareness and heal.
Okay.
Are you breathing?
Yes, I'm breathing. I need to set aside 3 to 4 hours and keep writing.
I would say with what's going on, with being a dynamic between you and your son, that would probably be really worthwhile doing. And then once you've completed, you know, just do a brain dump on the right side of the page. And then once you've completed it, then just go back over everything you've written and look at, you know, become conscious of those thoughts that were perhaps unconscious, and then determine what work you need to do around them. You know, you might look at one and it might be, well, this is a worksheet for me. This one, I should really be doing the commitment with my son. This one, you know, that's going to be a codependence worksheet to do. So look at which of the tools you're going to use to work through whatever comes up.
Okay. 4 hours.
And well, I think it's interesting that the context for this conversation and for you to select these two numbers just randomly out of the blue was on Friday. The question was, if I do my work, does it heal my former husband who's now passed? So I would say it's safe for me to invite the darkest parts of my family history to come forward, to come to awareness and heal, is probably about right on track for what your next piece of work is.
Yeah.
And so any support you need along the way, we're here. And we're holding the space, your heart.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, any other thoughts for you?
Well, I think I want to go on your website and review all the worksheets that are available so that those are fresh in my mind.
Fresh?
When I start this. Yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, well, we'll be holding the space. Delight to say hello.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. All right, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody else in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
No, but we did have a question from yesterday in the chat room, and we ran out of time, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
So it was Yinka, and she said the other day that you had talked about ADHD being a defense mechanism against attack and being hypervigilant. I have a few members, she's talking about of her book club, and friends with ADHD. I'm wondering what worksheets might be helpful for them to work on and any other information you have on ADHD.
Well, Yinka, as part of the Mind Shifters Distal Point Breathing Club, you've got the ever-expanding Mind Shifters list. So one first thing I might suggest you do is anyone that you want to work with around that issue, that you start out by inviting them to do a Mind Shifter, explain what the Mind Shifter is, how it's used, and then invite them to pick two numbers and they're ready to deal with. And so that would be a starting point. And then, of course, from there, it's all of the above. I mean, it might be a codependence issue. We're looking at a power person worksheet might be appropriate, or the codependence worksheet. It might be, you know, the space to take the commitment and the mirror with myself. It might be using the commitment with someone else. It might be the forgiveness process. It might be the responsibility communication. I mean, every tool under the sun is what's designed for whatever moves for people when they're looking at something like, well, any issue, but in this case, looking at the need to be hypervigilant and therefore having trouble focusing on, you know, anything for too long a time period. And so, and assuring them of the safety of looking within, and that they've got a space of support. You know, one of the reasons why, at least to me, why most people hide issues from themselves and don't deal with them is because they didn't feel safe enough at some point in their lives to look at these things. I mean, even to contemplate them. No. Hold my breath, put that away, get rid of that. I don't want to look at that pain and trauma. And so just that of creating a space of safety, it's like, it's safe to look, it's safe to allow things to open rather than running scared from something that we're carrying around inside of us. So the assurance of safety, the understanding of some of the principles, and then, of course, the more acquainted they become with each of the tools, the more quickly they'll work through any given issue that's ready to be processed. So that would be my offering in that regard, Inka. And for anybody who's listening, if you're listening on one of those stations where we can't see you on our control panel, our calling number is 563-999-3581. 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly on your phone. And then if you push 1, you'll raise a hand in the control panel, and Jean will introduce you by your phone number. So, delighted that you're here. And do we have anybody with a hand up, Jean? Anything happening in the chat room?
No, it's all quiet. You've got 22 minutes, so you could go back to reading.
Cool, let's go for it. So we're down toward the bottom of page 34 in the Enlightenment book. And again, if you're new to the show or you've recently returned to the show, what we've been doing for a few weeks now is reading through the Enlightenment book with the objective of understanding or building the brain cells to be able to adapt or adopt the Aramaic mindset, the Aramaic way of perceiving and letting go of the Western mindset that is so just monumentally different. So it's about building the brain cells, and if you are going to do this study with us and you'd like to get a copy of the book, it's a book that's in our catalog that normally sells for $25 plus shipping. And if you want to get a copy, you know, specifically so that you can be working with it or following along with us with the radio show, rather than ordering it from our catalog and paying shipping, if you go to our website, whyagain.org, down at the bottom of the page, there's a donate button. So if you want a copy of the book and you'll donate, the book is $25. If you'll donate $26, that covers what PayPal collects from us each time that somebody makes a payment. And then we'll pay the shipping. So if you want a copy of the book, just do that. Mark in it when you make the donation. If you go through the catalog and order it, it'll automatically add and force you to pay shipping. But we'll pick up the shipping if you want to order it by just doing that, Tony, through the website. So we're on the bottom of page 34, and we've been talking about different words that in the Enlightenment book were left in the original language. And the reason why they were left in the original language is because there that communicated that there was a new understanding to be acquired in utilizing that particular word, that there was no corresponding word in the English language that would match up with that Aramaic word. So we are at the stage where we're looking at a symbol that's added to the text, the last paragraph on 34, and that is the Aramaic word Kuba, K-H-O-O-B-A. And Kuba, it turns out, is a filter or a gateway that allows only units, it's a filter over the perceptual part of the mind, that allows only units of perceptual memory that are connected to or key to love to be used in building your mind's constructs. So it's kind of like, you know, we have this mind, and the mind can go anywhere. I mean, you've heard people make ridiculous, asinine arguments about why some of the most terrible things that have ever been done on the planet are good. You know, it's like crazy stuff. And if you really listen to that mind really believes it. And that's because that mind has no guardrails on it. And what the Aramaic, what the Aramaic teachings of Yeshua did was they gave us a set of guardrails for how to keep reason in check. Because you can bet that the guy who sold $100 million thought it was reasonable for him to do. The person who slaughtered, you know, this particular group of people, it was reasonable for them to do it. People always do reasonable things, but a lot of the reasonable things people do are really insane. And the reason is because they don't have any guardrails on their minds, so they can be convinced that anything is reasonable. So remembering that there are three filters over the perceptual part of the mind in the back of the brain. One of them is Kuba. One of them is fear, and one of them is hostility. If hostility is the active filter, the only quality of perceptual memory that will pass into the mind to be used for building your reality are those energies that are based in irritation. So if hostility is active, this person's going to have a perceptual construct based in threat. So hostility correlates to threat if that's the filter that's set. If fear is set, pardon me, I got that backward. If hostility is set, it's irritation. If fear is set, it's threat. So that's the quality of perception someone's going to have. You know, when they said to Yeshua, how do we tell where someone's at? He said, you'll look at their fruit. If the quality of your perception is everything you look at, you're irritated. You know, we have a statement that honors that one in this culture. It's not thought of as one of the guardrails on the highway to reason, but here it is. How many times have you ever said, yeah, he got up out of on the wrong side of the bed this morning? What does it mean? He got up with his hostility filter set. And everything he looks at seems to be the cause of irritation. Now, of course, that's all projection. The cause of irritation is the fact that in his mind is irritation. And when the hostility filter is set, the only data that his mind is able to use to build his perception will be irritation. And if the fear filter is the one that's set, then no matter who or what this person looks at, they're going to feel threatened. You know, why does a 6'5" guy who says he cherishes his spouse, who's only 5'2" and couldn't even start to threaten him, why does he raise a fist and hit her? Because his intimidation or threat. Not that there was any threat from her, but the actuality of the thing doesn't matter. If the mind's serving up a reality, then that's what's going to be acted upon. If Kuba is set, now again, there's no such idea expressed in, you know, any Aramaic word. If Kuba is set, then all units of perceptual memory that can be used to build the construct of the mind at the moment will be key to love. So, we earlier talked about Rachma, which is a similar filter, a corresponding filter over the frontal lobes of the brain where intentions are stored. And these two filters, when active, were called perfect love. So this Aramaic idea of Kuba is a filter that we're told we have to have for, in Matthew 5:44, our enemies, quote-unquote. The concept to be cued by Kuba did not exist in Western thought until psychological advances uncovered the controlling force of a set of mind. So this Kuba, this attitude, this mindset, which includes the desire for all-embracing affection for the other, and the cue control set, which causes what is good about the other to be perceived. So in the middle of a fit of irritation or experiencing feeling threatened from within and projecting that without, if Rachma set, even though that's activated, if one's committed to keeping that Rachma set, then one is going to go, oh yes, and I feel some irritation moving in me, but what I know is the goodwill that I'm committed to says that I'm going to cherish and honor this person. And so this is a way to keep your mind guarded against the unresolved hostilities and fears of your family system or your culture. Wouldn't it be nice if, let's say, some of the politicians that are out there today with some of the most vile, absolute, I mean, at every turn, vile language, and people are listening to that vile language, go, yeah, man, they're great. Look how great they are. Look at that, how awesome they are. It's like, I listen to that language and I say, what? You want a mind that uses that kind of language to be in control of our laws, our country, your family? Really? That's the most bizarre thing I've ever heard. When you watch language, you're watching what's going on in someone's unconscious mind. Now, what if these minds that are playing out with this just crazy stuff were actually able to stop and go, oh yeah, what I'm here to do is to function as the presence of love and bring love into the world. So if Rachma and Kuba are set, this cue control set causes that which is fair and just in the circumstances to come to mind and causes perception of whatever the highest and best of the wholesome desires of others are. So with Rachma and Kuba set, even though there's someone that, you know, the average person would say, well, that's my enemy, if Rachma and Kuba set, I can be a space of compassion and speak to the highest and best part of them. And here's one of the things we know. This is a focal point in our Laws of Living class that comes out of this Aramaic work, and that is that a particular energy moving in one mind will tend to continue or will tend to resonate and move the same energy in another person's mind. So if somebody comes into the space with hostility going on, and I'm not committed to Rachma and Kuba, they're going to tend to resonate my hostility. What am I going to do? I'm going to tend to buy into that hostility game, that fear and threat. If I have Rachma set, even if someone comes with that, I can still stop and go, you know, Bill, yesterday when I hear you're pretty upset right now, but you know, yesterday what I heard you talking about was how much you really wanted to get this project done for your kids. And you know, I really acknowledge you for that, and I can connect with you in that, and all of a sudden, instead of Bill's irritation about getting up on the wrong side of the bed this morning and, you know, wanting a fight, Bill goes, oh, yeah, that's right. The kids, they're really, and the whole thing is diffuse. Wars can be diffused that way. Because a condition in one person's mind, if there is a matching potential for that energy to be moving in another person's mind, it's going to move. So when I have Rockman and Kuba, I'm going to be attuned to, and we'll get more into this when we do the Beatitudes, to just and fair behavior, and in that state have the ability to perceive what is wholesome, what is decent, what is good about that other. So the text goes on to say, being only a mindset or attitude, Kuba does not include reasoning, judgment, or action, only the controlling sense, which, if sufficiently maintained, fill a memory with wholesome information and ultimately produces all-embracing love for the neighbor or creator and for the law upon which all hangs. So, in essence, what this does is the mindset of Rockman and Kuba creates a pathway for the essence of your being, your true human self, to stay present in your own mind and body while interacting with someone. So this is how you keep your own mind on track. Well, how do I control others? Well, you know, obviously you can't control others, but you have a powerful opportunity to influence others by maintaining those energetic patterns in yourself, which will tend, doesn't mean it's always going to happen, but will tend to resonate those higher energies in that other person's mind as well. So this is a guardrail for the mind. And it's so hugely important. I mean, imagine if the politicians that are running around puking on each other, tearing each other to bits, were like, oh, I'm here to be committed to bringing about love in my own mind and in the people around me. How different would the language be? So it's helpful to distinguish the result designated by Kuba from the energy that is indicated by the word Brahma. So these are two separate filters in the mind, one over the frontal lobes of the brain and one over the back. Rakma is that filter that allows the energy of love to come into one's physiology, and when one has that active in their minds, they will have an understanding of how the whole body of law, that is, how the way things work, hangs. You know, an understanding of that is a result of having both Rockma and Kuba, but in particular Rockma here. So it's a condition that allows your human life love to stay present for others no matter what they're doing. And so the result will be that love will be maintained in the presence of someone who otherwise would appear to be a threat. And you'll notice in you know, the next edition will be changing this, because there's been a real metamorphosis in our understanding over the last few years of the word love, where the error of thinking of love is the way our culture thinks of it. It's something we're going to do, something we're going to get, something we're going to give. And so this was written when that understanding was not as refined as it is now. So it will be added in the next version of the text to be used only to represent or be used only as a word that represents human life, represents the truth of who we are as human beings, not to represent something we're going to do to somebody else, something we're going to give to something else, someone else, or something we're going to get from someone else. So there's a correction there. So while Rotten works in concert with Kuba, that mindset of love, the presence of love represented by Rachma now brings in reason, thoughts, judgment, and behavior. If one is successful in maintaining Rachma for all men, Kuba, the all-embracing presence of love, the ability to keep your human life present for all others, will develop. With Rachma, the unique fact that Will Rogers never met a man that he did not like ceases to be unique because it becomes a natural result anyone can reach. If one maintains a mindset of Rachma and Kuba, and they're the two together were what was called perfect love, then the achievement of that mindset will be continuous, and cue controls then will fill one's memory, perception, reason, and judgment with what is good and honorable about others until the all-embracing presence of love is established. So to carry around or to be carried around in a mind that holds no energy that can obliterate the presence, the awareness of the presence of yourself as active love becomes one of the objectives here. To have a mind that can support that. And why is that not common in our culture? The words don't even exist in the English language, or the Latin language, or the Greek language. There is no such idea. You know, we hear all these different words. Oh, the Greeks had this word and that word and that word, all these different words for love. Filial love, you know, Philadelphia, brotherly love. But there's no such concept as Rachma and Kuba, which are literally, when active, the gateways that allow you and I to maintain the awareness of ourselves as the presence of love, and to bring that presence of love fully active into our minds, into our perception, and into our interactions with others. Under the ancient Aramaic understanding, the mindset Kuba produces a particular quality of judgment regarding another. Under modern understanding, it appears to do so by controlling present perception and the stocking of memory. In other words, what data is allowed to be used by memory informing one's perception. On the issue of how should I act in response to the question, how do I work with this person? Kuba, or how should I act toward this person? Kuba produces the answer of kenuta, another word that was left in the Aramaic, which is justly and fairly. In response to this question, how do I work with this person? Kuba produces the answer of humility. And humility, as opposed to the Greek idea of humility, is this grovel in the earth like a worm because you're lower than a snake's belly, is transformed into recognizing that I have a mental ability to see what is good and wholesome about others and their objectives. So that's humility. It's not about groveling. It's about having your own mindset so that you can see what's good and wholesome about another. And, you know, it may be something that's minimized in someone, but if you have that fully active in yourself, literally, you will resonate the next deeper level of that possibility within everyone that you interact with. And that's what transforms the world. And so we're down to our last